The next couple of presenters we're going to have up here are definitely experts in their field, and they're going to give us some insight into groundwater management and the world of groundwater policy, both at the local level and the state level. The first person we have up is Ted Engel, who is a geologist with the Texas Water Development Board. His interests include water issues across Texas, the surface water, groundwater interaction, and geology of West Texas. Ted worked for a number of years at the Bureau of Economic Geology. He was involved in oil and gas research in Utah, Argentina, and Brazil, coastal erosion on the Gulf Coast, and hydrogeology in West Texas and Arizona. With the board, Ted's been involved in a number of research efforts across the state, from the High Plains to the Lower Rio Grande Valley. He also manages the Aquifer of Texas conference series, which is an amazing set of conferences. I think they've had three so far. And we have in our landowner resources in the packets, we've got some information about the proceedings from those conferences that you can look up and get copies of from the board. But that's a great conference series that Ted manages or takes care of. So let's go ahead and invite Ted up here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that introduction, Laura. She's very, very generous. From our preceding two speakers who gave some really excellent talks, I feel like I'm standing in the footsteps of giants here. So we'll try to take what's otherwise a somewhat dry topic and make it a little interesting. I want to talk to you today about what I like to call the groundwater trifecta: the rule of capture, groundwater conservation districts, and groundwater management areas. That's a little too far. I sure did.
Give us the one that tell you, I won't
play okay. Please do. We can break the silence. So, as Laura pointed out, I am with the Texas Water Development Board, and I just wanted to point out our mission, which is sustainable, affordable, quality groundwater for Texans, our economy, and our environment. And specifically, I work in the Groundwater Resources Division, and our mission is to collect, interpret, provide accurate, objective information on groundwater resources in the state of Texas. So the first thing we want to talk about is the state's role in groundwater, specifically with the rule of capture. And to do that, I want to take you back in time a little ways to 1900 to an interesting town called Denison, Texas. Denison is up in the northeast part of the state. It's very close to the Texas-Oklahoma border. And this is a little picture here, an advertisement from the city of Denison in about 1890. And you can see, it's a pretty big town, actually. But what's important to understand about Denison is that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the railroad was as important as the Internet has been in the last 10 years or so. That was the focus of industry. And Denison was a railroad town. Denison happened to be the confluence of railheads from Missouri, Kansas, and Texas. And we'll get to why this is important here in just a second. Denison has some interesting claims to fame. Denison is the birthplace of President Eisenhower. Denison also boasted the first free public school, as well as the first women's club. And my most favorite is that the first use of the term flying saucer originated from Denison. Yes, it's true. It's true. When a farmer used those words to describe some dark flying objects above his land. So, Denison also has a very important root in our popular culture. So, railroad town. Well, railroad town's important because what does it take to run a railroad besides engines and rails? Well, it takes a lot of water. It takes water to run the engines, water to run the machine shops, water for the stations that the passengers come and go on. And so here we are, Denison, Texas. And you can see all these dark lines here lead to Denison. All railroads in this part of the country lead to Denison. And, I thought that was the most interesting thing about this is in 1900, the city of Denison boasted 10,000 residents. Well, in 1900, the city of Dallas only had 40,000 residents. So you can see at the time, Denison was not a small town. So you can see the Red River runs right through the center here, and all these rail lines lead up to Denison. So, the railroad needs water. What do? Well, they send out their good engineers, and they say, we need to find ourselves a source of water. And so they survey the area, and they realize that in most of this area along here, and specifically even in the center of the town of Denison, there's a lot of homeowners who have shallow wells, hand-dug wells, that they get their water out of. So at the crossroads of Owings and Lamar Street in downtown Denison, the railroad decides that they're going to go ahead and dig a well so that they can provide water for their engines and for the station there. So they see that there's all these household wells. And so they figure, well, everybody else's well is about 30 feet. It's about 5 feet wide. And if we make ours at least twice as deep and four times wider, we'd probably be able to get a little bit more water. And that's true. So the geology here, this is the Pawpaw Formation, and it's got a big sand top right here that grades into a more calcareous clay with the Weno clay right here at the base. So the railroad in 1901 digs their well. This is a gigantic well, as you can see. And Mr. East, who lives, we weren't exactly able to determine where, but lives between 100 to 200 feet away, has his little shallow, comparatively shallow 33-foot well. So in 1901, the railroad starts producing, and they get 25,000 gallons of water a day out of this well. It doesn't take very long before the surrounding wells, including Mr. East, start to go dry. So we need a sidebar note here. This is 1901. Long about 1900, the northeast portion of the state started to suffer somewhat of a drought. And in fact, between 1900 and 1902, they have about 30% less rainfall than average. And this is important. So the railroad's pumping their well. Mr. East's well goes dry. So do some of his neighbors. And, they do what any good citizen would do. Their recourse is to go to court, is to litigate against the railroad. So Mr. East and his neighbors put together their suit, claiming that the railroad had dried up the wells. Mr. East claims $1,000 in damages, actually $1,100 in damages. Now, for comparison, for perspective, that's about $25,000 in today's money. So that's what he figures his damage is. And he goes to court, and in 1902, the District Court of Grayson County rules against Mr. East. And they say that the reason is because there's no correlative rights, meaning that both parties are entitled to a fair and proportional amount of groundwater. So there's no agreement between the parties as to who gets how much groundwater. Well, Mr. East and his neighbors are pretty unhappy with this, and so they appeal it. And the Court of Appeals, in fact, reverses the decision. And they award him $206, which is right about $4,800 in today's money. And the Court of Appeals said that the use to which the defendant puts its wells was not a reasonable use of their property as land, but an artificial use of their property, and if the doctrine of reasonable use is applicable to defined streams to such cases, this was unreasonable. They're talking about the railroad, because the railroad is the defendant in this case. So the railroad's unhappy about this, and they go ahead and they appeal it to the Texas Supreme Court. So in June the 13th of 2004, the Texas Supreme Court basically lays the foundation of groundwater law in Texas. And they rule against Mr. East. And there's two reasons why they do this. And I want to go ahead and read these to you, because they're important. The Supreme Court looks in two places. They look to the English doctrine of law. And the English doctrine states, The person who owns the surface may dig therein and apply all that is there found to his purposes and at his free will and pleasure. And that if the exercise of such a right, and if in the exercise of such a right, he intercepts or drains off the water collected from underground springs in his neighbor's well, this inconvenience to his neighbor falls within the description damnium as abesque injuria. Pardon my butchering of Latin there. That which cannot become ground of action. So this is the first key piece. The Texas Supreme Court also looks to another state Supreme Court decision from Ohio in Frazier versus Brown, 1861. And the Ohio Supreme Court has two main issues here, two public policy rationales. And they say that in the absence of expressed contract and a positive authorized legislation, as between proprietors of adjoining land, the law recognizes no correlative rights in respect to underground waters percolating, oozing, or infiltrating through the earth. And this mainly form considerations of public policy. One, because the existence, origin, movement, and course of such waters and the causes which govern and direct their movements are so secret, occult, and concealed that an attempt to administer any set of legal rules in respect to them would involve hopeless uncertainty and would therefore be practically impossible. So secret, occult, and concealed. And their second point is, because any such recognition of correlative rights would interfere to the material detriment of the Commonwealth and drainage and agriculture, mining, and construction of highways, railroads, with sanitary regulations, building, and the general progress and improvement of works of embellishment and utility. So, the Texas Supreme Court stands on an old English doctrine and the decision from the Ohio Supreme Court that says, first, there's no way we can possibly know what happens in the ground, and secondly, if we attempt to do that, it's going to impede progress. So this is the foundation of water law as it starts in 1904. Now, I want to skip ahead just a moment to 1999, to a very important case that I'm sure most of you have heard about, Cipriano versus the Great Spring Waters of America. And what's really important in that case is that the court again stands on the rule of capture. But Judge Hecht makes a really important point here, and he says that I concur in the view that for now, but I think only for now, East should not be overturned. So that you can see, in 90 years, the court has recognized that it's important for the legislature to act with the powers that they've been given by the state of Texas. But at the same time, from this 1999 decision, you can see that the Texas Supreme Court has suggested that it's important for the legislature to go ahead and take their place in dealing with groundwater in the state. So, let's move on to Comanche Springs. And the reason why I want to go here is because this is a good focal point or good case, if you will, for what happens with the rule of capture. So, Comanche Springs, since 1900, has had tremendous flows. Gunnar Bruhn lists in Springs of Texas, Volume 1, that around 1900, these springs flowed at almost 1,800 liters per second. And that flow is pretty much sustained until the 40s, where it drops down to about 1,000. Now, what's important at Comanche Springs are two things. In the 1950s, the state of Texas saw what we consider the drought of record. So in our record of history of water data, the 1950s is the period where the state is the driest throughout the entire state. So Comanche Springs, located in Fort Stockton, you saw some pictures earlier from Frank's presentation. It's pretty tremendous. This is a picture probably in the 1930s. The drought of the 1950s comes in. Some landowners up dip of Comanche Springs decide that they need more water for irrigation, and so they drill some wells. and they pumped these wells. And along about 1951, 1952, some kids swimming in Comanche Springs realized that the water's not bubbling anymore like it usually is. And in a very short period of time, they start to see the spring flow decline dramatically. In fact, the Springs of Texas lists between 1948 and 1962, the spring flow falls from about 1,200 liters per second to zero in 1962. So, at the same time that these up-dip farmers are pumping and irrigating their lands, we need to look back just a little bit. The 50s are considered the drought of record, but in fact, in West Texas, the drought of record came early. It started about 1948, because that's when you start to see the decline in spring flow from Comanche Springs. So the water district there decides to go ahead and take the landowners to court. And it goes all the way to the Texas Supreme Court, the Pecos County Water Control and Improvement District versus local farmer. The 1954 decision, again, is that the plaintiff who supplied water to the property had used the water from Comanche Springs for 90 years and was denied injunctive relief from the operations of landowners who, by pumping from wells, had reduced at times the stoppage of flow from the springs. So once again, the court sides with the landowner because the wells are placed up dip from where the spring issues out, and so that's considered groundwater. And so that landowner has the right to drill a well and pump that water. Now, remember this here. Let's go forward to the legislature. I want to step back again. I'm bouncing around a little bit in time here. But I want to go back to 1917. Now, the state had seen, around 1910, had seen a drought, not quite as with the impact of the 1950s, but it was certainly significant enough that the legislature recognized this. And in 1917, there's a conservation amendment to the Texas Constitution that empowers the state to regulate natural resources. And that includes groundwater. And this is important because later on in 1999, the legislature uses that conservation amendment to pass the Texas Underground Water Conservation Act. Now, what's critical about this 1949 act is that this is what empowers groundwater conservation districts in the state of Texas. And when Carolyn gets up, I'm sure she'll have a few more comments about that. She's going to talk to you more about GCDs, so or groundwater conservation districts. So I don't want to steal too much of her thunder. But I'd like to point out that at the time that the pumping occurred and the springs dried up at Comanche Springs in Pecos County, there was no groundwater conservation district. So that's what allowed the rule of capture to have the impact that it did. Going the wrong direction. Let's talk a little bit more about groundwater conservation districts. In 1960, we had about 6 groundwater conservation districts in the state. And even 20 years later, by 1990, there are only half as many more. But you can see between 1980 and the year and 2000, another 20 years, the increase is more than fivefold. By last year, we have 285 groundwater conservation districts in the state. And we have 85 confirmed and 3 waiting confirmation. Now, it was pointed out to me that if we continue with this trend, like you've seen between 1980 and 2006, by the year 2050, we will have 700 groundwater conservation districts in the state of Texas. So, got to look on the side of the glass being half full. We're headed that direction. So let's take a look at them. There we go. So everything you see colored here is a groundwater conservation district in the state of Texas. All right. We have one unique district that is definitely worth mentioning because folks know a whole lot about it, and that's right here, the Edwards Aquifer Authority. Now, what's special about the Edwards Aquifer Authority is the way it was created. So we'll touch on that for just a minute. This is a picture of runoff from Comal Springs I really like some of these old pictures because you kind of get a feel for the expanse and what it looks like. It's very obvious that there's no development around here, but if you go to this area today, you're in the middle of San Marcos. So in 1991, the Sierra Club filed suit against the U.S. Secretary of Interior in the Midland U.S. District Court, alleging that the Secretary has allowed the takings of endangered species by not ensuring water levels in the Edwards Aquifer adequate to sustain the flow of Comal and San Marcos Springs. So the trial begins in November of 1992, and the judge rules in favor of the Sierra Club. And his ruling is this. His ruling is that the spring flow must be maintained, that the Texas Water Commission must submit a plan to the court by March 1 of 1993 to assure that Comal and San Marcos Springs will not drop below jeopardy levels, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service must develop spring flow thresholds for take and jeopardy at the Comal and San Marcos Springs by March of the same year, and that the Texas State Legislature must put in place a regulatory system to limit withdrawals from the Edwards Aquifer by May 31st, 1993. So this is a tremendous push for the legislature, because the legislature is already in session by the time this ruling occurs. So as tasked, the state legislature passes the Edwards Aquifer Authority Act May 30th, the day before the session closes in 1993. Now, since then, there has been a lot of litigation that's occurred with the EAA. But that's one district that is empowered directly to manage water levels and water groundwater taken from their district area, and has been authorized so by the state legislature. So let's go on to the third portion of our talk here, groundwater management areas. So all these red lines here delineate the groundwater management areas in the state, and there's 16 of them. The GMAs have a pretty long history. Up until 2001, the primary purpose was the creation of districts through petition process. So in 2001, as part of Senate Bill 2, the legislature gave the Texas Water Development Board the responsibility of placing all major minor aquifers into groundwater management areas. That's what this map is right here. So while a number of the boundaries of the GMAs do follow political boundaries, if you overlie this on the major minor aquifers of the state, they tend, especially, for example, like 11, 12, and 13, to follow what we consider the footprint of the Carrizo-Wilcox. 1 and 2 lie over the Ogallala. GMA number 4 encompasses most of the aquifers in the West Texas area. Number 8 covers pretty much most of the Trinity, with the exception of the Hill Country portion right here. Number 7 and number 3 cover the Edwards Trinity Plateau and what we now refer to as the Pecos Alluvium right here in number 3. So the Texas Water Development Board worked pretty hard to mash the aquifer footprint of the state, which recognizes no political boundary, and the political boundaries, which is the way we function as a state in our governance, together to come up with groundwater management areas. So Senate Bill 2 required joint planning if a district requested, and districts had various alliances that had some semblance of joint planning going on. So in 2005, House Bill 1763 requires joint planning within GMAs. So the groundwater conservation districts within these GMAs are now required to meet together and conduct joint planning. So, well, what does that really mean to us in the groundwater world? Well, I want to introduce these two new terms: desired future conditions and managed available groundwater. Desired future conditions is the management concept that the groundwater management areas want to use. They want to decide what it is that their aquifer is going to look like in the future. And so what exactly is a desired future condition? Well, you want to combine a physical aspect of the aquifer and some component of time. So, for example, water levels that do not decline more than 100 feet in 50 years. So, that's a desired future condition of your aquifer. Another good example is right down here. Spring flow must not be allowed to fall below 10 cubic feet per second in times during drought of record for perpetuity. So you have a physical condition, and this actually can be linked right back to this right here. Because as we've all recognized from the previous two talks, spring flow has everything to do with water levels. Water levels decline, spring flow declines. So your spring is the canary in the mine for the water levels in your aquifer. So this is a desired future condition. So these are the goals that the groundwater management areas are working to get to. Now, what are they going to do with that when they come up with a desired future condition? Well, then we have a managed available groundwater. So the end result is usually a volume or a number that we get to from a desired future condition pushed through our groundwater availability model, and you come up with this managed available groundwater. So this is the goal that the district is going to use to shoot for as a management tool. So while the state doesn't directly legislate groundwater, as our example was given to us in the state of Florida, indirectly through the empowerment of groundwater conservation districts and through their joint planning in groundwater management areas and desired future conditions, they come up with a managed available groundwater. So they come up with a number, with a tool that they can use to say in their district, this is what we want to maintain as groundwater in our district. So as with everything, timing is of the essence. And for now, in order for these managed available groundwater numbers to be included in regional planning in the state of Texas, which occurs on a five-year cycle, the groundwater management areas have been tasked with providing the Texas Water Development Board with their desired future conditions by December 1 of this year. So what will happen at the Texas Water Development Board is we'll take those desired future conditions and we'll put them into our groundwater availability models, and we'll come up with a managed available groundwater for the districts, for the GMAs, and for entities within the GMAs that request them. So the statutory requirement for the GMAs is that they submit desired future conditions by September 1, 2010. But as you can see, that'll be a little late in order for us to make the next planning cycle. So this year, the Texas Water Development Board brought to the legislature the 2007 State Water Plan. Excuse me. So our next planning cycle would occur in 2012. And that's why it's pretty important for the GMAs and the GCDs to bring forth their groundwater, their desired future conditions, so that we can help them achieve their managed available groundwater. So, if you'd like to learn more about groundwater in Texas, please visit our website, or you can give me a call.
Yes, sir.
Well, it probably could, but the key components of desired future condition is a condition of the aquifer. So indirectly, I would say that could be so. If there's a certain spring flow that's required to support specific biota, then that's your target right there. That's your aquifer condition. So that's how you. Next. Yes, ma'am.
In your desired condition, you had spring flow not less than 10 cubic feet per second, I believe. And how did you determine that for the spring flow of all different?
Right. These are just examples. So this is not, these aren't the three you get to choose from. These are just some, these are just some examples that we thought we would use to illustrate the concept of desired future conditions. So the Groundwater Conservation District or the groups within the groundwater management areas can pick whatever condition they want to call as their spring condition, as long as it's a condition of the aquifer. And the reason that's important is because we need to use this to put in our groundwater availability model to come up with that managed available groundwater number at the end. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, sir.
Are there any springs that are orphaned that are not in any of the districts? Or what would happen if the district future desired condition didn't include maintaining springs?
That's up to the district. So,
the Water Development Board doesn't
That's right. The desired future condition comes from the districts and the GMAs.
If
right.
Step in real quick, too, is that there's a lot of areas of the state, well, there's still areas of the state that aren't covered by groundwater conservation districts. And so within these GMAs, it's the counties and the different people that are involved with springs participate in these GMA processes and take on that role of what the district's doing. But that's a big issue with the state right now, is that lack of coverage of groundwater conservation districts everywhere they're needed.
I know that it's probably pretty faint, but you can see there's large portions of the state up here in northeast Texas where they don't have districts. But they do fall within a groundwater management area, and there is a process within the groundwater management area meetings for public input and public comment. So just because there's not a groundwater conservation district there does not mean that there's no mechanism for input to occur.
Let's take one more question.
Yes, sir.
The groundwater availability models are somewhat reasonable, and so one mile in Riverside. How accurate can they be in predicting spring flow of specific spring?
Not very accurate at all. And that's true, because you pointed out the model grid size is often at a mile. But you can get there indirectly by groundwater levels. So spring flow is tied in directly with groundwater levels. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So
trying to predict what that actual flow of that spring is going to be, that's not really within the capability of that model.
No, that's true. And a more site-specific model would be more efficient at doing that. But there's a threshold where water levels are going to maintain at least a certain window of spring flow. And when the water levels fall below that, you're going to know that spring flow is going to decline as well. So we're using a pretty big hammer. But again, as you all have seen, the aquifers in the state of Texas are pretty gigantic. And that's the tool that we have utilized right now. But certainly to predict specific spring flow, a more local model is more efficient.
Okay, let's go ahead and thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I wanted to mention, too, in your packets, we've included copies of the Groundwater Conservation District map that Ted showed, also the major and minor aquifers in Texas, and the GMA boundaries for y'all to use as a reference later on.